You're listening to Bill Handel on demand from KFI AM 640.
Serious side effects are mood changes like depression and mania, seizures, increased blood pressure or heart rate, liver damage, glaucoma, allergic reactions, may cause nausea, constipation, headache, and vomiting.
Bill Handel.
It's not for everyone.
And now, here's Bill Handel.
KFI, AM 640, live everywhere in the iHeartRadio app. Hey, coming up this Thursday, the 1st of June, June 1st, it's the first ever iHeartRadio Access Day featuring deals, including a one-year VIP access pass to all the live shows at our iHeartRadio Theater in L.A. Recent performer, recent performances. Thank you very much. Include Macklemore. I don't know who that is. Florida. Smashing Pumpkins. You can also get access to the Dodgers, Kings, and Clippers experiences. It's one day only. Move more info at iHeartRadioAccessDay.com. Okay. Let's do it. What is in the Biden-McCarthy deal to raise the debt limit? It was sort of going to happen anyway because both President Biden and Kevin McCarthy, Speaker of the House, said that not raising the debt limit is a non-starter. There was no chance it was not going to happen. However, it was actually a fight. And heretofore, that vote to raise the debt limit, allowing the United States to borrow money to pay its bills already incurred, have always been, that bill has always been clean. Politics were not attached to it. And now, guess what happens? Politics became attached to it. And over the weekend, the president and the House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, announced the deal to increase the government's debt limit and to avoid a debt default and economic turmoil. How about economic disaster? And here we knew it was going to happen. Both the president and McCarthy and their allies are framing the deal as victories. Everybody's winning on this one, and everybody's losing. McCarthy pointed that out, that this is compromise. And unfortunately, in today's political climate, Republicans, Democrats don't compromise. A compromise is considered a loss. A compromise is considered caving in. And legislation is all about compromise. That's what it's about. Okay, so what is the deal? Well, some temporary fiscal changes. McCarthy did agree to extend the increasing debt ceiling by 2 years. So they're not going to talk about it until after the presidential in 2024. And that means that Trump, who's probably going to get the nomination, at least I see it, and the president who's running again will not have to deal with it. The deal claws back $30 billion in unused funds from the emergency COVID-19 relief packages. Now, I want to point something out. The amount of money that was spent in the stimulus packages, the amount of fraud that occurred in the hundreds of billions of dollars, unlimited amounts of money, there's still $30 billion left in the fund that was unspent. All right. Here's one that I just don't understand. Last year, the Democrats put $80 billion into the IRS, and that was through the Inflation Reduction Act. And what it was for is enabling the IRS to modernize its operations, become more aggressive in tax collection. And guess what the Republicans said? No, thank you. No thanks for that funding boost for the service, claiming that middle-income Americans could see an uptick in auditing. Don't mention a word about the rich and corporations. See, they would see an uptick. Only middle-income Americans, which, by the way, they're making up. There's no proof of that at all. And so McCarthy clawed back $20 billion of that money. Now, the Democrats don't like it, saying it's going to benefit wealthy people and swell the deficit. But here is the choice. They preferred it to the threatened cuts in entitlements for low-income people, also climate change. That keeps on going, and maybe the Republicans will be able to sell it. The deal did not gut the $400 billion student loan cancellation, but it forbids the administration from unilaterally suspending student loan payments after the end of August, because that's what Biden did. Actually, Trump started it. He started saying during his administration, saying you don't have to pay back loans. We're going to freeze loan payments, which made a lot of sense during COVID. Well, the president, current president, says, I agree, and just kept on extending it. Now, I was looking at it saying there's never going to be a repayment back. And so Biden has repeatedly extended the suspension and last August announced the limited cancellation program. And then that's in the lawsuit, too. And then the SNAP work requirements. This is the food stamp program. It's going to phase in temporary work requirements for adults up to age 54. Right now, the current law requires adults up to age 49 to meet work requirements. And now it is up to age 54. So more people are going to have to meet these work requirements. Homeless Americans, veterans, adults in foster programs up to the age of 24 will be exempt. So who is fighting this? There are a couple, there are a handful of right-wing Republican lawmakers. They're opposing the deal outright, just outright. I'll tell you who is, even though he has absolutely no influence, is Ron DeSantis. Said the deal doesn't do enough to change the fiscal trajectory. After this deal, he said, our country will still be careening towards bankruptcy. Yeah, I don't get it. And it's a 99-page bill. If someone has read, of course not. And it is kind of a deal. Had to be made. We have to, outside of everything else, we have to be able to borrow the money to pay our bills. It's that simple. Otherwise, we go into a form of bankruptcy. Now, the federal government can't go bankrupt by law. States can. Did you know a state could go bankrupt? Did you know a county can go bankrupt? A city can go bankrupt? I think it was Stockton went bankrupt. County Orange County went bankrupt. Utilities have gone bankrupt, but not the federal government. A story that I have talked about many times is about police agencies and how they are understaffed around the country. And it is getting worse because, frankly, no one wants the job anymore. The San Francisco Police Department is down more than 600 officers, 30% of its allotment. Phoenix needs about 500 more officers. The D.C. police force is smaller than it's been in 50 years. And gun violence and carjackings are up. And officers are leaving way faster than they can be replaced. And police departments across the country struggling to fill their ranks. And it's to the point where it is an emergency that threatens public safety. And I'm not saying that. Current and former police officials say that. And you're talking about city council saying that. It's an exodus of veteran officers. And I'll tell you when it all started. In May of 2020. And what happened in May of 2020, the murder of George Floyd. And what ended up happening is that police departments all over the country were painted with a very broad brush. Now, I also want to say that accountability was brought to the forefront, that it is, I think, a lot harder today for police to use excessive force. So there are some good points to accountability and certainly looking at police forces with a microscope. But as is always, when the pendulum swings, it always swings too far. So what's going on? Well, increased hostility from the communities that the police, criminal justice laws that seek to reduce the number of people in jail, a philosophy, I don't want to mention any names, George Gascon, who believe that criminals should be rehabilitated and their people too. And they can be valuable members of society. So how do advocates for police reform look at this? Well, they're seeing this as an opportunity to hire a whole new generation of officers and reimagining policing, where everybody loves everybody. It's a very kumbaya look at society. We get the right cops in there, and we get cops that love people and are loved by people. That's the way policing should be.
I think they look at old time policing where you had the cop out on the beat, where it was the same police officer who walked the beat, who knew everybody in the neighborhood, who everybody respected, got the free food, the free donuts. Everybody thought the cop had dandruff. He didn't. It was powdered sugar. And that was the kind of policing that we loved. But those days are so gone. So what's happening? You got people leaving. You got cops leaving like crazy. So the police agencies are seeking fresh recruits. And the only way they're getting even the minimal number of police officers, and I mean far less than they need, is the qualifications have dropped. Lowering the bar. Now, one of the things, for example, is Steve Gregory will tell you this, to become a sheriff or to become an LAPD officer, the bar is still high. I mean, they've changed some rules. You could have smoked marijuana in the past. You could have tattoos that heretofore you couldn't have as long as they're covered up. And it's okay. There are certain things that are right, but the basic bar for being a cop has not changed. The post exam is as hard as it was. The psychological exam is as hard as it was. The physical requirements are as hard as they were. So that part is good. Sheriff Tom Dart of Cook County, for example, real problem. They're short of more than 300 officers. We're having to work really, really hard to fill what we have. And we're still not filling at the rate we want. So let's talk about Cook County. They have a 5,000 inmate jail, and they can't afford to cut corners on that one. Folks, because of the law, because of the judges, and for safety reasons. So what happens? They take those officers and they take them away from the patrol division. And on top of that, smaller police departments, let's say in the villages and towns, are also shorthanded, and they have asked Cook County cops to fill in, so it's a double hit. So it just can't be done. And it's just getting just beyond worse and worse. And it's become, it's you're going to see something happen. Right now, all you're hearing is the amount of or the lack of prosecutions that are going on because the jails are too crowded, because of the law is too lenient, how we passed Prop 47, how DAs like George Gascon, thank goodness he is in the minority, are dealing with prosecutions. But it's now reached the point where public safety is truly at risk. And for those people that are arguing, we need a new kind of police department. We have to reimagine the police department. Fewer officers, more de-escalation training, social workers that should be on the streets instead of police officer or in conjunction with police officers. You know, I'd love to see what happen. Here's what I'd love to see happen. Is one of those advocates for the reimagining of police departments. Now, keep in mind, I am fine with de-escalation training. I am fine with all of that. I think that is necessary. I advocate that. But I'd like one or two of these people to have a burglar come into the house and start calling 911. There's someone in my house. There's someone that's broken in, and there are no police officers. Sorry. And that has happened. So in April, the Justice Department, U.S. Justice Department, assembled about two dozen policing organizations, department chiefs, labor bosses, nonprofit leaders, and the recommendations are expected this year. Now, the head of this group, Associate Attorney General Vinita Gupta, said any solutions have to go hand in hand with police accountability and constitutional policing. I got it. They're right. But you can't have the pendulum swing this far, and it's going to bite us in the ass, truly. But I'll tell you what is pretty big news, and that is what's going on with the January 6th rioters. So let me give you a story. 2 months after he pleaded guilty to storming the U.S. Capitol, Daniel Goodwin appeared on the Tucker Carlson when he was then on Fox and promoted a website where supporters could donate money to him and other rioters, and the site called them all political prisoners. Okay, so he raises $25,000. the Justice Department wants him to give up, strangely enough, $25,000 that he raised. And this is a clawback. And it's a growing effort by the government on a couple of levels. Number one, to prevent them from being able to personally profit from participating in the attack. For example, Sum of Sam law, which was written, and this is New York, and I think it's federal also, that if you have participated in a crime and you write a book about it and you become notorious, that money does not go to you. You're not allowed to have it. So that's one issue. The other issue is if the public defender, if the rioter decides, or the rioter applies, the rioter decides to apply for public assistance, go to the public defender because he doesn't have any money. Well, if he raises money for his defense, then guess what? He has money for his defense. And he can't argue I'm destitute and can't afford to pay for an attorney. So the prosecutors in more than 1,000 criminal cases from the January 6th riot are increasingly asking judges to impose fines on top of the prison sentences to offset those donations. And dozens of these defendants have set up the online fundraising appeals to help with legal fees, including those that claim they're destitute and the government is paying for their legal defense. Now, prosecutors say, oh, yeah, there's nothing wrong with asking for help for attorney expenses. But there is something wrong in saying I'm poor and all of a sudden I've got a pile of money to pay for my defense. And the Justice Department is really questioning this. Now, there is one website that really raises this money. It's called Give, Send, Go. And it bills itself as the number one free Christian fundraising site. And it's become the number one go-to for the January 6th defendants. They can't use the other sites. GoFundMe won't let them on. And other mainstream crowdfunding sites simply say no, thank you. So this one was set up. And the rioters almost universally portray themselves as victims of government oppression, even as they're cutting deals to plead guilty, recognize their wrongdoing, showing remorse, cooperating with prosecutors. At the same time they're doing that, they're on these websites saying that they are victims of government suppression. And what does this show us? That there are a whole lot of people in the United States still view the January 6th rioters as patriots. And still, and this is, we know this, cling to the belief that the Democrats stole the presidential election from Donald Trump. And what makes it even more delicious, if you will, Donald Trump has said if he is reelected president of the United States, he will pardon most of the rioters because he views them also as political prisoners. There's a Virginia man, Marcus Malley, who is scheduled to be sentenced next month for assaulting the police at the Capitol. He's raised more than $16,000 from an online campaign, and that describes him as a January 6th POW, and asked for money for his family. Malley had a public defender and did not owe any legal fees. And he is asking, well, at least he's smart enough to say, I need the money to feed my family. That's not for legal. That's not for legal fees. A prosecutor wrote he should not be able to use his own notoriety gained in the commission of this crime to capitalize on his participation. And judges are listening to this, too. So far, $125,000 have been levied in fines against 33 riot defendants this year. And on top of that, judges are ordering hundreds of these convicted rioters to pay more than $500,000 in restitution to the government. So right now, we're seeing these serious, massive charges, very long prison terms. One just got 18 years, the head of the Oath Keepers, and or is the Proud Boys. And as they're sentenced, they also tend to be just huge prolific fundraisers. Nathaniel DeGrave, another one, was sentenced to 3 years and was ordered to pay $25,000. And he raised, and the prosecutor is saying the word incredible, he raised over $120,000 in this Give, Send, Go fundraising. And the description of him is that he is Beijing Biden's political prisoner in America's Gitmo. And the part that I find do I use the word chilling? Nah, not really. But certainly distressing is that these guys and women also plead guilty, show remorse, say they're sorry, actually cooperate with the government, and then turn around and go outside and raise money saying they're political prisoners. I mean, the sheer hypocrisy, but I guess it doesn't matter. When you are a political prisoner, you'll say anything. It's like you're being tortured. Same thing if you've been caught by the enemy during wartime and you'll say anything. And I think that's the way they are portraying it. Moving to the border. This is an article that was written in the New York Times by this woman, Dara Lind. Now, to start off with, and I looked at this and I thought there were some good points here that I want to bring up that I hadn't seen before. Now, let's start disclaimer time here. She's a senior fellow at the Immigration or the American Immigration Council. Let's just say she is very pro-immigration and not particularly a fan of America. So the American policy. So let's take that into effect. But she brings up a couple of points that I want to share with you. As you know, last month was the end of Title 42, which allowed the feds to expel unauthorized border crossers without letting them ask for asylum based on national security issue. And the national security issue was bringing back Title 42, which was passed in 1944. And in this case, it was because of health reasons. It was COVID. Trump administration said, we are not going to allow people in because of the fear of immigrants coming in with COVID. And that, while that sounds horrible, the Biden administration kept on going with it. So for those people, oh, that Trump is terrible on this one. Hey, look at Biden, too. He did the same thing until the end of Title 42, which happened last month. So what is going on? You know that there is now an asylum lottery. That's what's happening. It is a straight out lottery. And this happens to be one of the fair solutions that are out there. Why? Because of the mismatch between the number of people that want to claim asylum and the government's capacity to receive those people. And this becomes a real swirling mess. It becomes a cyclone of a problem because the answer is to give more assets, more money, more people. The program expanded to allow people to claim asylum. Well, the more people that are allowed to claim asylum, the more people are going to come to the border to claim asylum. And why is that? Well, because a lot of the world is a toilet. That's why. The number one, you think that it'd be Mexico that would be literally providing the greatest number of immigrants claiming asylum. Well, first of all, that's not true because it's almost impossible for a Mexican to claim asylum. So you have the number one group of people, Venezuelans. Venezuela used to be the richest country in South America. It was extraordinary. And I had the pleasure of going to Venezuela during that time when it was this rich, wonderful country. Caracas, the capital. I mean, it was like Paris, broad boulevards, extraordinary stores and people walking up and down the boulevard. It was just amazing. Tons of money because it had oil and lots of it. Well, then you had the Chavez administration come in, elected straight out communist, and was elected. And he became a despot and he died of cancer. And his hand-selected replacement was Maduro, who is also a straight out communist, nationalized everything. Anybody with money, anybody with education left. And now business is a fraction of what it was. And here is why the election keeps on going, because the number of poor people grows and grows. And the government subsidizes the people who have no money with bread, subsidizes them with flour, with cooking oil, gas, gasoline. You know how much it costs? What was the last time I looked at the price of gas in Venezuela? I think it's like 30 cents a gallon or 15 cents a gallon, completely subsidized by the government. So you have these people, and Venezuela is simply one of the countries. You have Guatemala, you have Honduras, you have people in the lower part of Mexico that are trying. There was that triangle with the three countries coming together. It is now a desert where it used to be this great agricultural area. I mean, it is horrible. So now you have untold number of people that are coming up and trying to get in the United States. And the problem with asylum for most of these people is if they're starving, they're not eligible. Starvation is not an issue. I mean, you could be there as a skeleton, literally starving to death, and you try to get into the country and you're not going to do it. It's political persecution. It is a fear of the narco-traficantes who have killed half your family. It is persecution based on you being gay. That's allowed in. So you go up to the border and you claim you want asylum. And the problem is you are not going to get in because this is a lottery and it chooses who's allowed to apply for asylum. And hundreds of slots a day are assigned to people waiting on the Mexican side of the border. They sign up using the CBP1 app run by Customs and Border Protection. And they have every 24 hours, there are about 100 slots or a couple hundred slots. The chances of getting in are almost impossible. Almost impossible. Now, the government says that the slots are awarded based on an algorithm that gives more weight to those people who've been trying for an appointment the longest. But a lot of that is random. A lot of that is pure luck. And if you don't get it, today. So you go on at midnight, and of course, by 12:01, it's all filled up. By 12 and 30 seconds, it's all filled up. And then you have to go the next day, and there are people that are waiting weeks and weeks and months, and that's the only way in. And if you try to go over illegally, which most people do, that is, well, you can't. You are tossed out of the country, and you can't come in for 5 years. So only people who have pre-registered for appointments at ports are allowed to seek asylum without facing other hurdles. And everyone has to meet a higher standard to, number one, apply for asylum and face an immigration judge. And on that one, it can take 9 months, 2 years to even face a judge. And that includes people who cross between ports of entry. I'm talking about illegally. And that is unlawful entry. And you get tossed out for that. Now, people who present themselves at ports of entry and lack they're asking for asylum, but they don't have an appointment, no chance. No chance. So it is so difficult. And what is the Biden administration going to do with that one? Well, one of the answers is, and I said earlier in the monologue, is just pour more money, of which the government, of course, is not giving the Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol more money. Because also keep in mind, it's not just people crossing the border. There's almost $2 billion a day coming into United States or Mexico with the trucks and the goods that are being shipped. And they have to deal with those, too. And keep in mind the amount of drugs that are being brought in. I mean, it is a mess. And the answer is, well, you know, how much more money can you pour? And it's the same thing with homeless. The more, let's say, permanent housing that are given to the homeless, the more people are going to be applying for permanent housing. I mean, it's a constant battle. It really is. And it's all going to be incremental, although at the border, I don't think that's incremental at all. Coming up, Tech Tuesday with Rich DeMuro. We'll be back with that. KFI AM 640 Live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.
You've been listening to The Bill Handel Show. Catch my show Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m., and anytime on demand on the iHeartRadio app.